Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Ellen Cassidy, author of We Are Here, Memories of the Lithuanian Holocaust. We'll also have visits from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. I hate to disturb your quiet August Sunday morning with distasteful material, but horror of horrors, it's time to start talking presidential election year politics from a Jewish perspective. You know, I have to admit that what will become a weekly Two Jewish segment this year again used to be one of my favorites to write every 4 years. And this is the third presidential election we have covered since we started Two Jewish way back in August of 2002. But now I just don't know. You see, it has to do with how politics is today. While I used to really enjoy the spectator sport that is American political party work, the silliness and the drama and the corruption and the unpredictable sliminess of it all, I'm coming to actually dread this particular presidential election season. It seems to me that politics have gotten only uglier and more expensive over recent years, with verbally violent, intellectually incoherent hostility expressed under the banner of a popular beverage celebration. No names, please. I always thought tea parties were held only by little girls. And verbally anarchic protest movements that are equally intellectually incoherent, occupying attention, if not intelligence. And the usual scandals, mistresses, illegitimate children, public bathroom busts of gay senators, governors on the take, are just nowhere near as much fun as they used to be. They just seem icky. Perhaps I've just gotten more squeamish. I mean, American presidential politics was always pretty sleazy, and I'm not just talking about Richard Nixon or even Bill Clinton. Campaigns have always slung mud. Grover Cleveland was accused of having an illegitimate daughter before he went to the White House. Abraham Lincoln was said to have black slave ancestry, and Andrew Jackson's wife was accused of being an adulteress and bigamist. Thomas Jefferson and James Madison supposedly authored some of the most heinous political slanders of their own day. John Adams tried to lock up all the opposition politicians at once when he was president. American electoral politics has been dirty since day one, and it never really gets much cleaner, no matter how hard the reformers try. So, I'm not really sure why I find it so yucky to wade through the gunk of contemporary American electioneering these days, to read the nutcase birther stories from theoretically responsible grown-ups who are sure that President Barack Obama wasn't actually born in Hawaii and is really a Muslim from Africa, and they are busy fabricating the legitimate documents just to prove it. Or the creepy anti-Mormon rantings about how Mitt Romney will turn the U.S. Treasury over to the Salt Lake City Church. Actually, from what I read, the Mormon Church is probably far more solvent than the U.S. Treasury right now. But it is a presidential election year, and while there is no drama about who the candidates will be, there is always a Jewish angle. And so, with all misgivings aside, we kick off this 2012 Jewish presidential election with our first Jewish presidential election moment. Hold the presses. President Obama will visit Israel if he's elected for 4 more years. We could expect him to visit Israel in a second term should he be reelected, pledges Colin Call, the president's campaign spokesman on the Middle East. The Obama campaign will be attempting to bolster credentials on Israel and the Palestinians as Republican rival Mitt Romney just visited the Holy Land. Romney, who was in London for the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games, then flew to Israel and met Israeli President Shimon Peres and Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu in Jerusalem. Actually, Netanyahu and Romney have a long-standing friendship dating back to when they were colleagues at Boston Consulting Group way back in the 1970s. Birds of a feather, perhaps? President Obama did not visit Israel during his first term, although he did go when he was running for the presidency in 2008. If you remember, that's where somebody stole the note he put in the wall and posted it on Facebook. Eric Cantor, the most senior Jewish Republican and the House Majority Leader, said the president's pledge to go to Israel was too late. It is emblematic of the lack of the close coordination with Israel that candidate Obama led us to expect in 2008, Cantor said. Democrats dismissed the congressman's comments. Being a friend of Israel shouldn't be judged by a travel itinerary, said Call. I don't think this is a serious policy difference. And judging from the fact that Obama visited a variety of Arab countries, most of which then overthrew their leaders, maybe it's just as well. That was our campaign 2012 Jewish election moment. No doubt they'll get better, and perhaps sleazier too. We can hope. It's just so American. On a less political note, although one that really does involve Israel, to play us in on this summer morning, here's a cut that has nothing to do with the presidency, but a lot about Jews. It's actually from singer Neil Sedaka, a former guest of Two Jewish, singing in his mamalush and Yiddish, quite well for a Turkish Sephardic Jew from New York named Sedaka. It's the classic V'ahin Zolich Gein, Where Shall I Go? And not just anywhere I can escape the presidential campaigning.
V'ahin Zolich Gein, Wer kann entfernen mir? V'ahin soll ich gehen, als verschlossen jede Tier. Es ist die Welt groß genug, nur für mir ist eng und klein. Wie ein Blick mit Zürich, siehst du stört jede Brick. V'ahin soll ich gehen? Tell me, where can I go? There's no place I can see. Where to go, where to go? Every door is closed for me. To the left, to the right, it's the same in every land. Tell me, where can I go? And it's me who should know. Won't you please understand? Dorthin will ich gehen, in mein Land, wo's ist frei. Dorthin will ich gehen, wie es als Findus nei. Ein Land wie Jiddischkeit blieb, lieben wird und Freider Jid. Israel in sein Heim, der Jid frei in sein Heim, dort dahin will ich gehen. Now I know where to go, where my folks proudly stand. Let me go, let me go to that precious promised land. No more left, no more right. Lift your head and see the light. I am proud, can't you see? For at last I am free. No more wandering for me.
That was the old pop star himself, Neil Sedaka, singer of Carol, Calendar Girl, Breaking Up Is Hard to Do, and Laughter in the Rain. That one was a classic Yiddish song about finding the promised land of Israel after the long diaspora. When we come back on Too Jewish in just a few moments, we'll meet our guest, author Ellen Cassidy, who has explored a little-known aspect of the Holocaust with thoughtful sensitivity in her new book on the Lithuanian Holocaust. Find out the shocking family secret she discovered when we come back in a few moments on Too Jewish.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. Every once in a while, I gotta do a little bragging. Nah, not about my grandkids. That'd take way more than 60 seconds. I'm gonna brag about our incredible family-sized pizza. Hey, this pizza is huge. I mean, it'll feed 11 or 12 people easy. It's so big that if you take one home, you might have to tilt it to get it in the door. But you know what's even more impressive about the family-sized pizza than its huge dimensions? It's the huge taste. We make this pizza the same way we make all our food at Mama's, with the freshest ingredients available. Vine-ripened tomatoes, fresh dairy cheese, superlatively excellent toppings, and of course, lots of good old-fashioned love. So come on down to Mama's and check out our legendary family-sized pizza or any other of our delicious items. And while you're there, feel free to ask me about my grandkids. I'll tell you all about them. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We're delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning, Ellen Cassidy. She has a new book out about the Lithuanian Holocaust and, Lithuanian Jewish history, and a great deal about a fascinating and interesting Jewish population that was substantially destroyed. The book is called We Are Here. Good morning, Ellen.
Good morning.
Tell us what prompted you to write this book and about kind of your journey in this process.
Well, when my mother was alive, I could count on her to keep track of the past, keep track of my grandfather who had come from Lithuania in around 1911 and all those who'd come before. But when she died, I felt that my family past was slipping away from me, and it had kind of fallen to me to keep track of it. I also missed Yiddish, which was the language that my mother did not speak fluently but used to kind of sprinkle into her speech from time to time, using a word here and a word there. And when I found out there was a summer course in Yiddish in Vilnius, the capital of Lithuania, I wanted to go. I wanted to connect myself to my past, but as it turned out, the trip connected me to my future as well.
There were a number of sort of shocking discoveries, surprises, really, in the course of this process. Once you were in Vilnius and studying, what led you to decide that you needed to write a book?
Well, actually, I started to get that feeling a little bit before I left. I stopped off on my way to Lithuania to visit my uncle Will, who was a Holocaust survivor I had known all my life. And I brought some maps I had downloaded from the internet, and I spread them out on the table and said, where exactly should I go? Where did you live? Where did you go to school? And he was in his late 80s, and he could put his finger on exactly where he had lived in the little town in the northeast of Lithuania, which is very exciting. And then he took me aside into the kitchen, and he pulled this worn slip of paper out of his pocket, and he said, "Read this." And when I read this piece of paper, I discovered a secret about my uncle that I had never known before. I had always considered him an unvarnished hero. In every way. He had saved my Uncle Aaron on a death march out of Dachau. He had saved some little girls in the ghetto. But I learned something about him that really shocked me. And that sort of turned my whole view of my family upside down and sent me off in a new direction.
Well, later in the show, we'll have to hear what that secret was. And that means you have to come back on Too Jewish. We're visiting with Alan Cassidy. We'll be back in just a moment. Among my most pleasant and least time-consuming duties, I have the honor of serving as president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, which celebrates the memories of Rabbi Samuel S. and Aarma Kohan, my grandparents. Once a year, the foundation gives a substantial cash award to an individual for outstanding service to Klal Yisrael, the total Jewish people. This service can involve any one of four different fields: unity, education and information, creative arts, or rescue. If you know anyone who might qualify for the 2012 Kohan Award, just visit our website, kohanaward.com, that's KOHON award.com, and you can find the nomination form there. And while you're there, you can also learn just who my own grandparents were and who participates in honoring their memory today. That's KOHONAWARD.com, KohanAward.com. It's a good visit and a great place to learn about a terrific award and all the recipients.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, Fetrick Fell, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website or download us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gilbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So we both came back from Israel not too long ago. Jerusalem is the e-ticket ride, a term that nobody remembers anymore. It is the ultimate tourist destination in Israel and one of the great tourist destinations in the world, sometimes voted the number one tourist destination in the world. We both came back from there. I've lived there some. You've been there many, many times. Let's talk about the experience of an American going to Jerusalem today. It's different, isn't it?
It is different, and I saw that experience. I didn't experience it myself.
Of course.
I wasn't an American going to Israel, but I was lucky enough to be sent by the Jewish Federation to be the staff person on the Young Men mission that went to Israel. And it was very interesting to see how those Jewish young men, around their 40s, coming to Jerusalem.
And only in Tucson are people in their 40s called young, but never mind that.
And it was, you know, for me as an Israeli, it was quite shocking to see the spiritual experience, the emotional experience that they went through while coming to Jerusalem. At one of the days, we started in the morning touring Ir David.
Yeah, it's fantastic, the new excavations there.
It's amazing. It's the place they believe that King David basically lived.
His palace was built there. It was really the center of Jerusalem in David's time.
Right. And by the way, you know, interesting to note, it's east from the old city of Jerusalem as we know it today. It's
Silwan, Shiloach.
It's in Silwan. It's basically in the center of an Arabic village, which also brings interesting political thoughts to mind. And you're going through Ir David, you're going downstairs, you're getting to the Nikbata Shiloach, to the Shiloach Spring, which is also, some believe, was the river that flew through Eden at the story in the Bible and so on and so forth. And then you end up climbing uphill on another excavation tunnel that they found, which is actually the sewer of the old Herod's
Roman Jerusalem.
Castle there, right. And stuff. And you end up coming to the Western Wall. Later on, we went on the Western Wall tunnels. That kind of shows you that the Western Wall, or the Kotel as we knew it for many years, is only a tiny, tiny, tiny piece of the real wall that was there and the real temple that was there that was huge. And after that, we took the men to the Kotel. And at that point, I remember one of the guys, he just touched the Kotel and he started crying. He couldn't stop for about 10 minutes. He was so emotional. He felt as if his entire Jewish identity, his entire Jewish life, were kind of concentrated into that moment of touching the Kotel, touching the Western Wall. He felt everything encapsulated into those, you know, seconds or time and space location of the Kotel. And for me as an Israeli to see it from the side, that was amazing. That said it all. It's beyond words. It's beyond knowledge. It's something that goes deep into the heart and soul of being Jewish.
It does. Guy, thanks. It's still an amazing experience to go to the Kotel. We will talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You have just returned from France, from Avignon, which has a tremendous Jewish history.
Right. I once actually did a stage in the prefecture in Avignon.
Okay,
so
you
I lived and worked there.
Gotta translate.
Okay, sorry. An internship in the prefecture. There's really no English word. The French governmental system that has existed for a couple of centuries is modeled after the Roman system, which is a very centralized state, and the capital has what amounts to embassies in each département. And a département is somewhere between a county and a state, but it's not a federal system. It is ruled top down. And the representative of Paris is the préfet, in English, probably prefect.
Prefect, right.
And the préfet has a lot of power and prestige. He's basically supposed to run his préfecture and keep everybody in line. So he's got his own secret service and network of informers on people who might be political dissidents or, at a different period in time, religious dissidents, heretics, whatever. I mean, this goes way back, this structure. And I was privileged to, as part of my academic year or so at the French National School of Administration, to serve as an intern in the préfecture in Avignon, and the département that that serves is the Vaucluse.
It's a tough area to have to be stuck for.
Well, it's famous for wine, like Châteauneuf-du-Pape and all the southern Rhone Valley wine, Gigondas, Vaqueras, etc. It's fabulous, and it's also beautiful. And lots of tourists like going there. And I was showing around two couples who were quite interested in sites of Jewish interest. So since I know that's what you most want to hear about,
not
the wines and the other things, I will tell you that in Avignon, right in the middle, there's a place called Place Jérusalem, Jerusalem Square. And on that square is a beautiful synagogue, which was quite old, was destroyed by a fire a little bit over 100 years ago, was rebuilt at the expense of the city of Avignon because they wanted the Jews to stay and they wanted a synagogue, and there wasn't fire insurance in those days, I guess, although that's just conjecture. And when I lived and worked in Avignon, which is now almost 30 years ago, 25 years ago anyway, I went to the synagogue on Friday nights and high holidays and whatever, and the congregation was largely of North African origin, of recent arrival. But when you look at the walls, you see that there was a certain period when it lists like the deportees in World War II, where there were plenty of Ashkenazim and people with Central European names too. So the demographics of that community have changed over the years. But this time it was quite interesting because I was with a young couple who are originally American, but they live in Israel, they speak Hebrew, and the guy who was showing us around as the shamus spoke perfect French, obviously, because he was French, but also Hebrew because he lived in Israel too. And he had some quite interesting stories to tell us, which I will share with you next week.
That sounds great. So we'll go back to the south of France next week.
Look forward to it.
Thanks, Tom. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. And this one is truly an all-time classic. A Jewish Bubby. Is there any other kind of Bubby, by the way? Anyway, a Jewish Bubby is walking on the seashore with her grandson. Suddenly, a huge wave comes in and sweeps him out to sea. "Please, God, bring him back," she cries. "I'll do anything. I'll pray three times a day, keep strictly kosher, give 10% of what I have to tzedakah. I'll be nice to my son-in-law. Anything, just bring him back." At that moment, another wave crashes into shore, depositing the boy unharmed at her feet. The Bubby looks up at heaven and says sternly, "He had a hat." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish Just For You. You should live and be well and find the hat. And now a word of Torah. You know, as a people, we Jews are good at many things. Kvetching, of course. Lashon hara, gossip, telling people things we shouldn't. We're also good at eating. And perhaps most importantly, we're good at asking questions. Perhaps the greatest of all Jewish questions was asked in this week's Torah portion of Akev, third Sedra in the book of Deuteronomy. It reads, V'ata Yisrael, ma Adonai shoel me'imach, which means, now Israel, what does God ask of you? And the passage in Akev continues that you have awe of the Lord your God, walk in God's ways, love God, serve the Lord your God with all your heart and soul. That great question, what does God ask of you? And our portion of Akev's answer begin a series of statements, arguments really in Jewish tradition, attempts to distill from our large moral storehouse just what the essence, the ikar of Jewish ethics really is. What is it that God wants? What is the true standard we need to uphold to be considered morally good? The section in Akev lists a few things we need to do for God's sake. First, revere God. Second, walk in God's ways. Third, love God. Fourth, serve God with all our hearts and soul. And fifth and finally, we're told that we must guard and do all the mitzvot, the commandments of God. It's a clear and quite powerful list. Fear God, walk in God's ways, love God, serve God, follow commandments. 500 years after that, the great prophet Isaiah distilled these terse commands into an even more concise version. Cease to do evil, learn to do good, he began, and then listed, seek justice, relieve the oppressed, uphold the orphan's rights, take up the widow's cause. A century later, the prophet Micah refined the formula again. He asked, "What does God seek of you? Only to do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God." A simple, clear, and beautiful formulation of ethics. And then finally, Hillel, 400 years later, just over 2,000 years ago, said it most concisely, "Do no damage to others. Don't seek to destroy another human being, for you would never wish that upon yourself. Be sensitive and decent, and of course learn Torah. Study ethics so that you may best know how to live to this standard." It's a very high standard that's established for how we should live our lives, but it's one we can achieve if we choose to do so. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, Ellen Cassidy, will reveal some fascinating lessons from her study of the Lithuanian Holocaust and some surprising revelations about her own family and even her Jewish identity when we return on To Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft, and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114. We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
An important and controversial and highly influential figure passed away in July. His influence, both positive and negative, was extensive in the Orthodox Jewish world and in Israel, but you may never have heard of him. Rabbi Yosef Shalom Eliashiv, an eminent authority in the Orthodox Jewish world on applying the Torah and particularly Talmudic law to modern times, whose rulings on conversion, divorce, and even legitimacy of Whigs from India had far-reaching impact and sometimes roiled Israeli politics and the popular scene, died in July in Jerusalem. He was 102 years old. Rabbi Eliashiv, may he rest in peace, was born in Lithuania and moved to the British Mandate of Palestine in 1922, the Yeshuv. He was known as an eminent posek, a decisor of Jewish law, a title earned not by appointment, but by scholarship, reputation, and the communal trust built up over decades. Rabbi Avi Shafran, the public affairs director of Agudat Yisrael of America, a leading Orthodox organization, called him the premier posek of the generation. For decades, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, may he rest in peace, who lived in Manhattan and died in 1986, was regarded as the world's leading adjudicator of Jewish law. Eliashiv followed him. Rabbi Eliashiv's decisions were honored, if not always obeyed, beyond his own ultra-Orthodox, non-Hasidic world, the Lithuanian or Yeshivish Jews. His word influenced Hasidim, Orthodox Sephardim from Muslim countries, and many modern Orthodox Jews as well. Slender, with a wispy white beard and penetrating eyes, Rabbi Eliashiv represented a rigorously conservative approach to Jewish law. It sought to safeguard our traditions against the assaults of modern life. He opposed service in the Israeli military for yeshiva students, very politically controversial today. He called that a plot to uproot Torah from Israel. He disapproved of professional studies for women. He insisted that for purposes of organ donation, death occurs when the heartbeat and breathing stop, not when brain activity ceases. And in 2004, perhaps most famously, he banned wigs from India made of human hair that were used by Orthodox wives to conceal their actual hair in public. He did so because the Indian hair had been cut off in Hindu ceremonies, or so he believed, that he regarded as idol worship, and thus violated the fundamental Jewish belief in the oneness of God. Within days, women in Jerusalem were casting their wigs into bonfires. Women in Borough Park were wrapping their heads in scarves or flocking to stores to buy new wigs made out of synthetic hair. Rabbi Eliashiv's opinions, for years he was a member of Israel's highest Beit Din, its rabbinical court, were crucial to controversies within Israel about who is a Jew, and when is a marriage truly dissolved, and when is conversion legitimate. Always, he was on the conservative side. He clashed with the Israeli government in the 80s and 90s when it arranged the conversions of hundreds of immigrants from the former Soviet Union, arguing that a true conversion required a sincere pledge to observe the laws of Torah, including keeping kosher and observing the Sabbath. The rabbinate has since extended that to somebody committing his entire family to those things. Eliashiv opposed Israel's unilateral withdrawal from Gaza in 2005, but eventually instructed the political representatives of the Degel HaTorah party, which was where he was affiliated politically, to support Ariel Sharon, then prime minister, in pulling out the remaining settlers, many of whom were Orthodox. Eliashiv cast decisions in the most private cases, too. Hundreds of Jews would stream to his extremely modest home, a one-bedroom apartment in an alleyway in the ultra-Orthodox quarter of Mea Shearim in Jerusalem, to seek his opinions on their personal quandaries or simply his blessing. They also came to his nightly lessons on Talmud as shiurim, most of which he knew by heart. The breadth of his knowledge was outstanding, said Rabbi Yeruchim Silber, executive director of the Borough Park Jewish Community Council. Yosef Eliashiv was born in Lithuania, April 10, 1910, only child of a woman, descended from a renowned Kabbalist, Rabbi Shlomo Eliashiv. After the family moved to Jerusalem, young Yosef was enrolled in the Ohel Sara Beit Midrash, where he impressed the land's chief rabbi, the first one, Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, with his quicksilver grasp and retention of Talmud. Though surrounded by fervent anti-Zionists in Mea Shearim, Eliashiv grew close to the establishment rabbis who worked with the Israeli government to advance the state. Rabbi Eliashiv himself followed the suggestion of Rabbi Cook and married a rabbi's daughter. The couple had 5 sons and 7 daughters, 6 of whom married prominent rabbis. One son died of illness as a child. One daughter was actually killed in 1948 by Jordanian shelling. In 2009, one of Rabbi Eliashiv's great-great-grandchildren had a son. That child represented the 6th generation of living Eliashivs. In all, the rabbi is survived by about 1,000 descendants. For better and worse, he was the authority in the Orthodox world. May his memory be a blessing. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Jewish our guest this morning, author Ellen Cassidy. She's explored the world of the Lithuanian Holocaust for 10 years. Her new book is called We Are Here, One Woman's Exploration of Lithuania's Jewish History, combined with her personal exploration of her family's history. Her translations and articles have appeared in Bridges, a Jewish feminist journal, Shofar, an interdisciplinary journal of Jewish studies, The Forward, the best Jewish newspaper in the world, probably, and Hadassah. Welcome back. Ellen, you told us that you discovered a kind of secret from your uncle, whom you thought of as a great hero in the Holocaust, saved your other uncle on a death march from Dachau, and you found something else on a slip of paper he showed you. Tell us about it.
Yeah, well, as I was on my way to Lithuania, my uncle, who was in his late 80s, surprised me by pulling this slip of paper out of his pocket and saying, "Read this." And what was on that piece of paper revealed to me something about what he had done in the ghetto that had to do with the very controversial matter of the Jewish ghetto police. Now, during the Holocaust, the Nazi command in Lithuania and in other countries required the Jews of the ghetto to appoint for themselves a police force that would go around and help the Nazi command carry out whatever they wanted to do. And sometimes that meant some really murderous things. Sometimes it meant just, you know, how do we distribute the food or how do we make sure everybody has a house to live in the ghetto. But sometimes it meant some much darker activities. And a good deal of what I ended up exploring in Lithuania was, what was the meaning of this in my own family? What had my uncle done? And what did that mean for me as somebody who was a member of the post-Holocaust successor generation? I didn't live through it. I don't know how I would have responded if I'd been part of it. And what do I do with that information?
So in the camps and in the ghettos, I often call them capos.
Yes, in the camps, the capos were in charge of rousting people out of bed in the morning, out of their bunks, and lining them up in lines and so on. But in the ghettos in Lithuania, it was sometimes more complex, and I did not reach the conclusion that my uncle was a monster, but I had to think about what was he exactly, and what is my role as a member of the successor generation after the Holocaust? What am I to do with this information of his complex moral character? Another thing that led me down this road was that when I was on my way to my ancestral village of Rokiškis in the northeast corner of Lithuania, I heard from a curator of the museum there that there was an old Gentile man in town who had witnessed the terrible happenings of 1941 when the Jews of the region were assembled in a field and marched off into the forest. And those memories had haunted him all his life. He was an old man, and he wanted to speak to a Jew before he died. Would I be that Jew? And I have to say, I was not at all eager to be that Jew. But given what I just heard from my uncle and how shaken up my view of the good guys and the bad guys and the blacks and whites of the Holocaust had been, I decided, all right, I can extend myself and I can spend some time with this man. And that was a really kind of a life-changing experience for me, to talk to somebody who was a man who I would have thought of as basically an evil or amoral or immoral bystander to terrible happenings. And I really got in touch with some of the complexities of what he had faced, what he had wanted to do, what he regretted not having done. And that was something that was very precious to me and sent me off again in a new direction to look at how other people in Lithuania are exploring the truths of the Nazi past and of the Holocaust. And I spoke with a number of educators who were helping people in this land scarred by genocide to engage with the past in order to build a better future.
You know, different parts of Europe have dealt with their Holocaust legacy quite differently. Germany, in some ways, has been the most forthright about facing its tremendous responsibility. Austria, not so much. Where does Lithuania fall on that spectrum?
Probably pretty far down the scale. One thing that I think as Westerners we're less aware of is that right after the war, Lithuania became part of the Soviet Union and went through a whole close to 50 years of oppression or occupation by the Soviet Union. And that was a situation in which the Holocaust could not be dealt with forthrightly. When it was dealt with, there was an agenda, and, for example, for many years, the word Jew was not used in talking about what happened during World War II. After the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991, Lithuania got to work and began to engage with the past, both the Nazi past and the Soviet past, and a lot of emotion came bubbling up. And unlike even in Poland, which was not an actual republic of the Soviet Union, they're way behind. And they've been criticized justly for lagging, for not dealing with criminals from the Holocaust era, for harassing Jewish survivors and so on. But I met some really wonderful people who are not that way at all and who are working very, very hard to bring Lithuanians in contact with the past and having them ask questions of themselves, such as, have you ever stood by? Have you ever stood there thinking I should do something and yet not done anything? And how does your answer to that question relate to what happened during the war? I think these are questions, these bystander questions, that we all need to ask ourselves no matter where we live or who we are. And it's beginning to happen in Lithuania. I can't say whether, on the whole, things are going in a good direction there or in a bad direction, but I did see, when I was there, some very sincere efforts for people to ask themselves questions about the past and embrace their Jewish heritage.
This process, this sort of journey, was not just about exploring the results of the Holocaust or the experience of coming to terms with it, but also really a personal journey for you. What did you learn?
It was, as I say, really a life-changing journey for me. And I went to Lithuania pretty much in the mindset that I had grown up with, which was I'm stepping into enemy territory. I'm meeting people who I'm very suspicious and distrustful of. I am not like them. They are not like me. And I am the victim, and they are the perpetrators and bystanders. I ended up feeling that, especially in so many years out, we're really doing ourselves and others a disservice if we hang on to the fears and hatreds of the past so tightly. And I think, you know, if I had lived through the events of the Holocaust, if I were, say, my uncle, I don't ask that people who have personally experienced the most terrible times in the 20th century, I don't ask them to step back, to step forward and reach out to others. Sometimes I think it's inappropriate to move on beyond hatred. But for me, I think that I can do better, and that I can sort of try to meet people, even people from other cultures, as moral beings, potentially moral beings, people like me. And so by the end of my journey, when I was singing the partisan hymn, "We Are Here," Mir Seinen Do, which is composed in the Vilna Ghetto.
Yeah, Zugnit Kainmol, of course, from Vilnius.
Yes, Zugnit Kainmol. We all stood up at the Vilnius Yiddish Institute to sing that song, and I've always considered that song kind of almost pathetic, because so many people who had sung that song had died in the ghetto, that it was almost like "We Are Not Here" would be more appropriate. But spinning through my head as I sang were the images of the old man in Rakishkis who was haunted and wanted to bear witness, the woman who was traveling around the countryside asking her fellow Lithuanians to ask themselves really searing moral questions, the people who had started a project for school children to talk to their elders about the Holocaust. And I felt, all these people are here. We're all here. We're all in this together, and we're all needing to explore the past together and draw conclusions that will help us build a better and more tolerant future.
One of my early performances as a cantor was going to a third generation, I suppose, to Vilna group in Los Angeles, and singing Zugnit Kainmol, by the way, where they also sang Vilna and some other songs. There's a tremendous connection that Lithuanian Jews had to the great scholarly history of the Lithuanian Jewish community, the Litvaks. Is there anything left?
There is, and when you go to Vilna and open your eyes, you can see a number of things. One is the many plaques that have been put up to mark the spot where things happened, both wonderful things and terrible things. And then also, it was so important to me just to stroll around the city and look at the sky, look at the buildings. There's a small Jewish community there. There are 2,000 Jews in Vilna itself, another 2,000 spread around the rest of the country. There's a thriving Jewish community center. There's a Jewish school. There is the Vilnius Yiddish Institute that I attended.
Right.
Great pleasure.
The book is called We Are Here, and tell people where they can find it.
We Are Here, Memories of the Lithuanian Holocaust, can be found on any online bookstore. You can go to your local bookstore and ask for it. Published by the University of Nebraska.
If there still are any local bookstores out there in America.
There are one or two, I think. Yes,
at least a couple.
And they need our support.
Thank God. I should note that it's, of course, deeply imbued with the Holocaust, it's more than that. A really interesting, beautiful book. I want to thank Ellen Cassidy for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest on Too Jewish and get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best.
To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. I love the fact that when people come into Mama's, they feel right at home. For example, a lot of times they'll walk up to the counter and give a shout out to my nephew Vinny, or they'll see Liz and ask her about the kids. The truth is, people feel at home at our restaurants because that's how we feel about our restaurants. But Tucson's a big town, and there's still a bunch of people who haven't experienced Mama's friendly atmosphere yet. They don't know that the Spina family opened the first Mama's back in 1980, or that our pizzas are made from the freshest ingredients, or that our sauce goes all the way out to the edge, or that we have an absolutely huge pizza called the Mama's Family Size Pizza. So whether you're a Mama's regular or a newbie, we invite you to come on home to Mama's Family Style Pizza, calzones, and hero sandwiches. We've got four convenient locations that you can find on the web at mamasfamous.com. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza!
Thanks for joining us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. And come next Sunday at 9 a.m., we will be celebrating our 10th anniversary show of Too Jewish. Our guest will be Congressman Ron Barber, the successor to Congresswoman Gabby Giffords. Of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or on our TooJewishRadio.com website, and please like us on Facebook. Our playout this morning comes from the Abba Yudaya, the Jews of Uganda. It's called Ali Omuyeka, You God Are My Only One. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week we pray of peace.
Dekane panke kuwanze ni nomuruji wange Joko muruji wange moyo yedo kita wange Zenewe mbanga ndwate moyo yedo kita wange Newe mbanga njapu wate moyo yemugaga wange Moyo yemuruji wange Moyo yemugaga wange Msera likire nyoku wanze ni nomuruji wange Kita wange, oyoye do kita wange. mukunzi wange kyoka kane wane kubanze nino mulungi wange mundegenze ne pa kubanze nono mukunzi wange
nina mukunzi wange ayo muyeka tesiri na mulala wabulo yo mukunzi wange
nina mukunzi wange nze ayo muyeka tesiri na mulala wabulo yo kwena londa yeka
nina mukunzi wange ayo muyeka tesiri na mulala